Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of The Week That Really Was with John McGurk and Sarah Ryan for this week ending the 3rd of May, 2024. It is blessedly a bank holiday weekend. I am gasping for it. I'm going to have my feet up. I'm going to watch the Miami Grand Prix. I'm going to watch Manchester United attempt once again to play football in a comical manner. And I'm going to enjoy my bank holiday weekend. Somebody who is not going to enjoy her bank holiday weekend because she is working for a political campaign is our resident glutton for punishment. How are you, Sarah?
Being punished.
How's it all going?
Like, the campaign is going well. I'm pretty happy with it, but it's just a lot of work, and you forget because it's a while since I've been involved. It's not the big things, it's the little things, you know, and it's just a serious amount of work, but it's also fun. And Niall Boylan is a good candidate, and a lot of people respond really well to him, so it's kind of like easier in that way. But then when so many people want to be involved in the campaign and so many people are contacting the campaign, that's kind of overwhelming in itself. It's a job in itself, you know what I mean?
Of course it is. For those who don't know, it's Thursday, isn't it, Sarah, next week posters will start appearing.
Yeah.
Which means that on Friday, that is when the press releases from various Tidy Towns committees will start landing in my inbox, announcing that such and such a town or a village is a poster-free zone by agreement of the self-appointed Tidy Towns Committee, who during election campaigns take on the power of unelected dictators banning candidates from their region. So you have that to look forward to as well. Although I don't think it's as bad in Dublin as it is in various parts of Connacht, Ulster and Munster. But that is a constant feature of campaigns. But if you're just an ordinary citizen, expect to see election posters adorning your lampposts for the local and European elections from Thursday of next week. Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the events of the week that went or that has just passed. And Sarah, I think it's been dominated by the latest edition of the Irish government's semi-permanent war with the Brits.
I mean, words you thought you'd never say, right?
Not really. I mean, like, they've been fighting with the Brits for years now. It was Brexit. Then there was a while where we were better than they were. COVID. There's this sort of general sort of like, whenever things aren't going that well in Ireland, it's the, well, like, look at the mess they're making it over yonder. Aren't you lucky to live in a place like this? And now it strikes me that sort of 2 years after this immigration issue arised as an issue, there was a conscious decision made this week to try and pick a fight with the old enemy and say, look, this isn't really our fault. It's being done to us by the feckless Tories in London. Which is interesting because the figure that they cited of 80% of people coming across the border from Northern Ireland, that's not new. I mean, I think my colleague Matt Tracy did a piece last August about how 77% of new applications are being made in the IPO centre in Dublin as opposed to at the airport, suggesting this has been going on for a while. So am I wrong to be cynical, or do you think it's like a genuine issue that's arisen this week?
What do you mean, that it's arisen for the first time?
Yeah. Do you think this kind of row is a sort of genuine, like, you know, oh, we've just discovered this, how awful, or do you think it's all a little bit convenient?
Oh, no, it's always convenient. I mean, it's always, that's what it's always about. I mean, like, it depends on what way you look at it. But, like, I mean, the issue on Mound Street, take that in its isolation. We were discussing that on the podcast months ago. Do you remember when I was telling you that I went in and I was stunned? And it's only gotten worse. So, you know, and there was definitely pressure building around that. I think what I found the most amusing about this week is that I'd say, oh, across the water, when Helen McEntee came out and said that 80%, was it 80% she said?
Yes.
I'd say, like, you're involved in politics, I'm involved in politics, whatever. Like, talk about a gift. Like, talk about a political gift that you've just said publicly that our policy is working. Thanks. Yeah.
Laura Perrins, I think you know Laura. She's on this podcast with us.
Yeah.
But she's an Irish barrister. She worked in the UK for years. She's got impeccable connections in sort of Tory England. And she wrote a piece for us this week. And she was telling me herself that basically they're popping the champagne corks in London. Like, Micheál Martin is the toast of Toryland.
Yeah.
As is the Irish government, because they basically, in the week that the UK launched this policy, the Irish government has endorsed it and said, look, all these migrants are now leaving Britain, they're coming elsewhere. The Tories are obviously in very bad electoral shape, and by the time you're listening to this, they've probably taken another shellacking in UK elections. But nonetheless, I mean, what a boost for them to be told effectively that their immigration policy is working tremendously well and people are leaving the country on foot of it. I mean, you couldn't get a better endorsement than that.
Yeah. So it's, and it's doubly bad on this side, because I don't think that anybody believes that this is to do with what the UK have done. It's going on longer. It's much more ingrained. There's much more history to this than just it simply being about that. So A, it's doubly bad, because it's great for them, and it's also worse again for the government here, because nobody believes what they're saying.
Hmm. What's more is, if you listen to the justifications that are being made for blaming the Brits, so obviously this Rwanda policy was only passed in the last week or two. No one has been sent to Rwanda from the UK yet. I don't think that's scheduled to happen until July of this year, when the first sort of people will be deported to Rwanda. But the government are actually, the Irish government are actually saying things like, well, people have been coming here because of the threat of the Rwanda policy. They've been coming to Ireland because they're afraid of the Rwanda policy happening. So basically what you're telling me is that incentives matter, that, you know, that migrants are rational people who behave in accordance with impending changes in policy or things that might happen, or how likely their application is to succeed. And they're all leaving the UK and coming to Ireland, and this is the UK's fault. I mean, what about having some incentives of our own? I mean, has that ever crossed anyone's mind?
Yeah. But it's also like acted as a really nice distraction, because the truth is that, you know, things in Newtown Mount Kennedy and, you know, the kind of wider country, I think, have taken a really negative turn in the last week in particular. And, you know, Newtown Mount Kennedy kind of is only one location, fine, but it's kind of captured the imagination in a bad way of the public. And this offered kind of a great distraction from that, because I think that they're failing miserably, you know, from a PR point of view, in that. And then I think that from the Taoiseach's point of view, like this business of like kind of clearing off Mount Street this weekend and moving everybody away, like remains to be seen whether they come back. But kind of blaming the Brits and the whole back and forth with the Brits has done, you know, they think has acted as a good distraction. I don't think it's worked. I don't even think it's worked with one member of the public, literally. But I think that they think it's worked.
Yeah. I do think there's a danger they're deluding themselves into thinking it's working. Because I want to talk a little bit about Newtown Mount Kennedy. Because obviously that we recorded our last episode on the Thursday morning. And then I think it was the Thursday evening things really kicked off in Newtown.
Every time we do it early, something mental happens.
And the bad news is we're doing it again early this week. So but if you're listening to this and, I don't know, a nuclear bomb has hit Dublin, I mean, it's our fault, blame us. But what happened in Newtown Mount Kennedy, I think, was interesting on a number of levels. First of all, I just want to say to the very many hundreds of people, and it is literally hundreds, like 300 plus people, who made a point of writing, emailing, or otherwise reaching out to Gript this week to ask after Fatima Gunning. Thank you. That was very touching. She is okay. She's fine. She got a dose of pepper spray in the face. She managed to turn her face to the right just at the last second, so most of it didn't get in her eyes. A little bit got in one eye, which was obviously deeply unpleasant for her, but she is fine.
I saw her on Saturday. We were at the Countess event, and she is fine, but she's such a she's such an amazing personality. And then he said to her, so out of curiosity, you know, what does it feel like to get pepper sprayed in the face? And she said, it feels exactly like you imagine it feels like. It feels like pepper spray in the face. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, yeah, so not great then. She said, no, not great. But she's an amazing, like, kind of brave person to just keep going.
She is. And it's heartburn inducing for me as her editor, because like, I don't want her to be getting pepper sprayed in the face. And yeah, like, I'm not saying anything in public. I haven't said to her, but like, I was like, you know, Fatima, like in future, just like, you know, I'm delighted you got the shots that you did. It's incredible footage. And just to say that footage has been picked up and used by Sky News, multiple international outlets reached out to ask us to use that footage, which shows its quality of the work that she's doing. But like, you don't need to stand that close. Don't put yourself in the line of fire. I think that's
she's
important.
A woman, like she's a slip of a thing. You know what I mean? She's not. She could get really hurt.
Yeah, which nobody wants. No. But anyway, not to make it all about Fatima, because she was by no means the only person pepper sprayed there. That incident was sort of, I thought it really interesting to watch. It was the first time I think I've seen probably government/Gardaí spin sort of slowly fail in real time. Because the initial reporting, obviously, from people who weren't there was based on the Garda statement that, you know, they were attacked, they responded with moderate force, you know, they cleared the road, etc. There was misinformation and disinformation circulating online, the Gardaí said, which they didn't specify what that was, didn't say what the misinformation, disinformation was. We went in, we did our job, we maintained public order. And ordinarily, I think that would hold. But the fact that not only Fatima was there, but a lot of other people had their mobile phones and so on and kind of showed what happened. And then you had that incident on, I think it was RTE's Upfront program on Monday evening, where there was a young woman there whose father had been injured in the protests. And a lot of like ordinary, not in inverted commas, far right people from Newtown Mankendy who are saying, no, this isn't what happened. The Gardaí, you know, certainly there may have been jostling earlier on in the day, and, you know, but the Gardaí went in there to batter people out of the way to open this thing up. And there was a lot of bad feeling in Newtown Mankendy over what happened. And I think a lot of people around the country, certainly from what I heard this week, were not buying the sort of official explanation that this was the Gardaí responding to attacks on them. Because those protests had been going on for 6 weeks before that without any of this kind of incident.
But I think that you just touched on a phrase there, which is kind of symptomatic of the problem overall, which is that ultimately so much trust has broken down between the public and politics, the government, whatever, is that people aren't buying anything anymore. Like, there's just this cynicism. And by the way, for the most part, I agree with it. I mean, I think that we've been gaslit by the government on immigration for a few years. I think we've been gaslit on other things. I think we're constantly kind of called names if we ask questions, and then only for what we say to later be, you know, become government policy without anybody acknowledging that people have been saying that for years, whatever. So I think that the whole conversation loop between the government and the public is just disintegrated so much so that the public just aren't buying much of anything anymore. And I from Simon Harris's point of view, I think that's going to mean that he's going to be, you know, unable to do much with his tenure as Taoiseach. But I also think that it's like, it means that there's a huge percentage of the population at this point now that no matter what the government do, won't be listening.
Yeah, it does feel an awful lot like, it feels to me actually this week, I look at what the government is doing and I see a real attempt to kind of shut the stable door. Like yeah. There was, this morning, for example, there are reports that the cabinet will consider further slashes to the benefits available to Ukrainian refugees, which kind of feels to me a little bit like, and I hope people will bear with me when I explain what I'm saying here, feels a little bit like performative cruelty. Feels a little bit like, you know, oh, well, the public are, you know, like, what I mean is this, the government believes its own bullshit in that it believes that all of this sort of anger about refugees is actually secretly racism, that people don't like refugees, that people are anti-foreigner. And so the government's reaction is, well, let's be mean to the foreigners. Let's cut their benefits. Let's slash the, you know, let's do what the racists want us to do. Let's batter a few Ukrainians. Let's drag a few people off the streets and so on. And that'll get us in with the kind of far right crowd who like oppose us. I mean, that seems to be the attitude. But in actual fact, and I'm not saying there aren't some people out there who do think like that, but the vast majority of sort of Joe and Joanne Soap in Middle Ireland are looking at this and kind of going, we've no particular problem with Ukrainians and we've no particular problem with Africans or Georgians or whoever they are. It's just, we cannot cope with these numbers and you won't manage the system properly and you won't restrict the numbers coming in and provide us with a sustainable working system. So rather than actually do that, the government has just decided to like make a show out of kicking a few foreigners for the week. But that's how it feels to me.
But that's kind of the, again, like that's kind of the, that's the symptom of loads of things. Like I think, like you and I have been friends for 20 years, whatever it is now. And like, we've been involved in lots of different campaigns over the years and we would have leaned, you know, towards conservatism on a lot of those campaigns and lost, right? And not been in the majority. But ultimately, I think that what you're explaining there is actually, of course, this, you know, and I hate to use this expression because it's so overused, but like far right, you know, really like, you know, racist people out there, or whatever. But that's, you know, that exists in the human condition everywhere, right? But like, ultimately, I think that what you're describing there is that for the first time ever in the last year or so, I think I'm in the silent majority. I think the majority of people in Ireland, and I think that the referendum was really like affirming in this for me, because the referendum became about lots of different things, including what it was actually about, but also about messages to the government and whatever. But like, I think the majority of people think, of course, Ireland would fall apart without immigration. Of course, we need people to come to Ireland. Of course, it's great to have people from other countries, whether it's the Ukraine for reasons of war, but whether it's from other countries who come to Ireland and create a life here and set up their families. And if they're in need, they should be supported. I think people think that. I think that people think that you should be respectful to people who are trans or who are whatever, and that they should be given respect and they should be given the same rights as everybody else. But. I think that's what most people think. I think most people are fair and decent and, you know, kind. But when it's rammed down your throat all the time and you're called names if you ask questions and you're told that you're this, that and the other, and you're aligned with the far right for asking these questions, eventually you start to end up with a situation where people get angry, they get pissed off. And this is what we're living with now. It's that the majority of people are fine. They're decent. They're nice. They're kind. They believe in some kind of immigration. But you've gaslit them for years. You've told them that if they ask any question or said, like, I literally have people that I know personally whose political opinions I respect very much, who I can remember the conversation roughly 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, where I asked them at a dinner and said, but there are people arriving who are arriving into Ireland on a plane and they have no documents. So where did those documents go missing? And I was told, that's really verging on racist now. You're really verging on racist. And I said, how? Like, how is that verging on racist? That's a question about our immigration policy. And now that person says to me, oh, sure, that's what you do in politics. Like, you know, that's what you do in politics. Okay. But that attitude right there is why Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the Greens are so, like, hated, because you've been gaslighting people for 2 years.
I'm not going to take lessons in politics from anyone in a party that has gone from 44% of the vote when I was young to 16% in the most recent poll. I mean, if you've been doing politics for Fianna Fáil for that length of time, I'm not going to take your advice. But I think there's another element to this as well, which is it's also not. Like, what's happening in Newtown Munkendi is also not entirely about immigration. Immigration is the proximate sort of focal cause of what's happening. But it's also about something more fundamental, which is fairness. Because I don't know how many people I've seen during the week from Newtown Munkendi make a very basic and obvious point, which is that the planning laws have been entirely suspended. So if this was any other development, literally any other development that was happening in their town, if somebody was putting up a wind farm, if somebody was opening a new hotel, if somebody was building like 500 new houses for Irish families, then the people in Newtown Munkendi wouldn't have to stand outside and protest at the site, because they would have, you know, every ordinary legal recourse. They could go down from planning objections to the council, to on board Planola, to high court injunctions. So, frankly, if you're trying to build a house or anything else in the country, it's too difficult to do it. And yet, all the planning laws in relation to this issue have been entirely suspended. So people have literally no recourse. They have no democratic say in their own village or town in a way that they would have for anything else. And it's that feeling of complete disenfranchisement, I mean, that is also really infuriating people. And the government is actually making it worse. There's a headline in one of the newspapers today. Now, I have to stress, it's a headline. It's in another publication. I haven't verified its accuracy. But nonetheless, I trust the newspaper in question, which says that Roderick O'Gorman is now looking to actually buy and rent Irish private homes into which to put migrants and refugees. So, like, you know, literally competing with Irish people looking for somewhere to rent by renting them for foreigners. That to me is just a recipe for absolute public outrage. I can't understand the thinking behind it. I cannot understand, like, why there is no one in government with the political antennae to go, this is going to, I mean, you're really risking, like, we're already seeing around the fringes with the Dublin riots last year and with what happened in Newtown Mount County during the week. And I don't want to say I'm putting blame on the people in Newtown Mount County for this, but we're seeing public order starting to fray around the edges here. I don't know if that's understatement or not. And I, the government keeps pouring fuel on the fire, frankly.
But is it because, so, like, serious question, you know, like, you've, again, been involved in politics, whatever. So Roger O'Gorman has a bunch of advisors or whatever. Do you think that it's they wake up in the morning and they are so oblivious to what's happening on the ground or whatever that they just go ahead with it? Or do you think they know people are going to be annoyed and they don't care?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I think Roderick O'Gorman is in the same ideological camp as Breed Smith. And I'm not saying he has all her same views. But a structure in the week, I mean, say what you want about the hard left in this country. But they're not.
I will. Thank you.
Yeah, you and you often do. But yeah. one thing that can't be said about them is that they don't abandon their principles just when those principles become unpopular. And Breed Smith struck me in the doll this week in the debate that the Rural Independents started on the immigration issue. Like, she's running for the European elections, and she's effectively running on a platform of infinity migrants. You know, there should be no borders. Anyone who wants to come here should come here. Anyone who suggests otherwise is stoking fear of black and brown men. You're a racist. It's a disgrace. Now, I could be surprised, but I don't think Breed Smith is going to feature in the final counts in the elections. And I think if she wished to, she wouldn't be saying that. I also think, but I think she sincerely believes it. And I think Roderick O'Gorman sincerely believes it. I think there's some, at some stage, people have got to put down the sort of, you know, this is all a conspiracy stick and pick up the, we elected somebody into high office who fundamentally believes in a world with no borders and anyone who wants to come here from the third world being accommodated and put him in office. That's what we did. And that's what Roderick O'Gorman sincerely believes. And he's got a mandate from the Oireachtas and the Dáil to continue doing that job until next year. And the only solution to that is to elect somebody with a different view and ensure that they're in government. Mm. I mean, that's what I think, fundamentally. I mean, I listen to people, you know, coming up with all these kind of exotic rationalizations for why government is doing this, that, you know, and it's kind of like a reverse of the Irish government's attitude to the Brits. You know, it's not us, it's the bad Brits. There are some opponents of the Irish government who will actually make excuses for them and kind of say, oh, well, it's not really them. It's the EU making them do this. It's the World Economic Forum. It's so on and so forth. It's somebody hiding behind the curtain pulling the strings. No, I mean, it's like in The Wizard of Oz, where you pull back the curtain and the Wizard of Oz was just a little guy with glasses sitting behind the screen. Well, in Ireland, if you pull back the curtain, it's just Roderick O'Gorman sitting there with his glasses.
It's like when, you know, like you and I have had this conversation before, where there's a few people I know, like that I, you know, I'm friends with from, you know, from when I was young, maybe school or whatever, and I'm friends with them on Facebook, and they're full on kind of conspiracy theorists, and they think that, you know, the government is this, and, you know, that this is happening behind the scenes or whatever. And I'm just like, guys, if you really want an antidote to that conspiracy theorist, just spend a bit of time around politics and politicians. Like, we can't even get a metro. They're not, like, they can't do anything. They're not all keeping a secret of some kind of agenda behind the scenes. They can't, like, they couldn't organize a piss up in a brewery. So don't worry. They're not in cahoots with the World Economic Forum or whatever it is you think. Now, like, no one's spraying chemtrails across the sky. They just don't have the organizational skills.
Yes, and I will make the point that we often make on this program, which is that the National Children's Hospital was first proposed when you and I were both 6 years old. Yeah. And it looks like if it is ever built, it will be built when we are both in our middle 40s and your youngest child is too old to use it. So, I mean, that ain't the World Economic Forum. That is institutional political incompetence.
And it's funny though what you're saying though about Breed Smith, because, like, I mean, I don't think this will come as a kind of a screaming surprise to anyone to say that, like, I could not be different. Like, I could not be more ideologically opposed to Breed Smith if I tried. I mean, I'd say we couldn't even agree on a flavour of biscuit, like, to be honest. But I do have, and always have had, you know, a kind of a respect for people who have an ideological position, and that you can tell in advance what their view is going to be on a certain issue. And over time, especially in the last kind of 10 years, this kind of flip-flopping ideological wishy-washy crap that Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin are doing is kind of, I think, more reprehensible now in a way, because, like, you don't know what you're going to get. Like, people voted people voted for it, but like, there's a lot of water under the bridge between the last time we voted a general election and today.
Well, for me, it just kind of shows, like, I've thought that this era in Irish politics can be called the Micheál Martin era. He is the dominant figure. He is the most consistent figure. He's been there since, I mean, he's been elected to the TD sometime in the mid-1980s. He's been a senior minister since.
And he'll still be down. He's the children's hospital of Irish politicians.
He predates the children's hospital. Yeah. He's been a senior cabinet minister. He was first appointed in 1997, I think, as Minister for Education. You know, he's 3 years off, basically 30 years at the very highest levels, is either a cabinet minister or the leader of the opposition. And he has told the same lie for 30 years, which is that he's a centrist. And when I say he's a liar, I mean, I don't think he's consciously lying. I think he thinks he's a centrist. I think he thinks
that when he's gone from being a pro-life conservative to a liberal pro-choice person.
No, but let me finish my point. I think he thinks he's a centrist because he would say, well, I'm not wedded to the ideas of right or the ideas of left. I mean, I think both sides have good ideas. And, you know, I think it's important to find the balance that works for the Irish people. I think there's a little bit of him that genuinely believes that. But the truth about Micheál Martin is that for 30 years now, he has had no ideology except what's popular. Or what he thinks is popular. So that's how you go from being a wedded opponent of abortion to the most liberal abortion campaigner in the country. And I'm not using that because we have a particular view on abortion. It's just an example of like an issue. But a lot of people have fixed principles.
Yeah, it's a good indicator because it's one of those issues that tends to be quite entrenched in a kind of a personal feeling as opposed to, it's a good indicator. If you're like, you know what I mean? You're not changing your mind on whether, you know, a Lewis like station should go through whatever town. You're changing your mind on something that is supposedly quite inherent to your sense of right and wrong, which is, you know, should take a huge leap, but obviously for a lot of people hasn't.
Yep. He's been on different sides of almost every issue, depending on, you know, what's popular on a given day. And he always makes this same defense that he's a reasonable rat. No, you're not. You're lying to yourself and to the whole country. You're just somebody who follows whatever way you think the wind is blowing. And the problem, Micheál, is that in the last 5 years, you've not noticed the wind changing. That's the problem. And the wind has changed and Micheál is standing there and his flag isn't working. And now he's suddenly the leader of a country that, you know, where the policy this relentless progressive policy that he's enacted for the last 15 years is suddenly unpopular. He hasn't a clue what to do. So you have the spectacle of him and then the even more pathetic spectacle of Simon Harris standing in front of a Virgin Media microphone this week saying, I was appealing for people to be calm. Just take some of the heat out of the conversation. I mean, come off it. Who's been calling people far right for the last couple of years?
Yeah. Come on. Seriously. I think, though, I mean, look, it remains to be seen what happens in the next general election. And, you know, fine, we'll see what happens. But I think that, like I said already, I think like the clock is running out on this kind of cynical politics. I don't think people buy it. I think people see through it. I mean, when I think, and this is a really interesting question, because I think if you're like the leader of Fianna Fáil or the leader of Fine Gael or whatever, like, you know, in the past, and I'm not, I said this before, like, I'm not like criticizing or slagging anybody off here, but like, if you're a party that's, you know, naturally, let's say at one point on kind of 30 or 40%, right, whether it's Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, and you have a really good election, like, You've tinkered around the margins on how successful that election could or couldn't be, but ultimately those people were voting for you no matter what campaign you ran. And so I think that there's been in the past a kind of an overestimation of people's political nous or political kind of skills or strategic skills for politics. And now when you see like Fianna Fáil, for example, is currently this week on the lowest percentage polling wise that it's been in, I think, since whenever. I mean, certainly since 2011. You know, I suppose what is an interesting question to contemplate at this point is, who do you think is, as a party or as a person, who's the best strategic campaigner, like campaigners as a party in Leinsterhouse?
God, that's a big question. I mean,
who's doing a good job at capturing, you know what I mean, at taking like the what's happening in Ireland right now and turning it into something that people can vote. Because like So for example, like, I would always say that, like, Independent Ireland and ANC, right, for 2 years or 3 years, whatever, I'd constantly talk to people and be giving out, be saying, oh, this, that, whatever. And they'd say, it's nobody to vote for, it's nobody to vote for. And now there is, right? So you could say that, to a point, you could say that ANC and Independent Ireland are both capturing something there. And I think independents in general and ANC will probably do quite well. But who's doing the best job? So for example, like this week, we see the Sock Dems have gotten into a dispute with a Jewish candidate that they had in BlackRock, who's been removed from the ticket, right?
For reasons, the Social Democrats won't comment on the reasons why, which is just a terrible look, by the way. I mean, like, that just lets us all imagine the very worst, which is that you got rid of her because she's a Jew.
But like, to me, with the point that I'm making is that we had, you know, the media darling, Holly Kearns, you know, they had two formidable, you know, whether I agree with them or not, two formidable women leading that party for a period of time. Now, fine, they don't want to run again or whatever they're doing. They wanted a new leader. But I think that they thought, oh, this media darling, you know, she'll be wonderful or whatever. And like, I think that these kind of situations are where you see the rubber hit the road, if you know what I mean. Like hard stuff, not being brought into the Virgin Media studios and fawned over and told how wonderful. And then you give this breathy kind of, oh, it's a terrible kind of thing. And nobody ever challenges you thing. These are the issues. These are the things that come up in politics where you actually have to be like savvy, where you actually have to pivot, where you actually have to say, okay, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to manage the messaging? How's the party going to approach this? And we're left wanting because they won't even comment on it, which is massively amateur in my opinion. But there's a huge cohort of people in Irish politics who are never challenged. Holly Kearns is one of them. So the point I'm getting to is that I think that there's a real lack of political like smart. Yeah, like, but I'm not talking about talent as a politician. I'm talking about talent for capturing, for listening, for being on the ground, listening to what people are talking about, thinking about whatever, and then like translating that into a message that's actually put out to the public that captures the public's imagination that the public can actually get behind. I think that that's gone. I like for a period, I thought Sinn Féin kind of had it, but like at least a year now, absolutely not. So who?
Well, like, there's a couple of things I'd say. I mean, for my answer would be in terms of like, who are the politicians who are managing the moment best? I mean, if you're referring to that as people who put themselves in a stronger electoral position as a result of the events in the country, then you can't look past the independents. And I'm not talking about necessarily ANC or Independent Ireland. I'm talking about people like Carol Nolan, who had a fairly marginal seat at the last election, whose seat I do not think will be marginal at the next election. People like Matty McGrath, who are the Healy Rays, I think, who you might say have been safe anyway, but like who are now definitely safe as houses. But if you want to look at the other side of the ledger, I mean, I don't know if you're getting this sense. And to be honest with you, unlike in the referendums, I don't know if I can trust your sense on this one for a reason that I'll explain, which is that you're obviously involved in the campaign, so you don't have the same neutral nose you did in the referendum. But my neutral nose, I'm getting the same kind of weird feeling I got in the referendum campaign, which is that the polls, if you look at the polls are telling us essentially that there'll be a little bit of churn. The Sinn Féin will make gains, that Fine Gael will kind of stay where they are, the Fianna Fáil might lose a few, that independents might gain a few. And yet that doesn't tally with, you know, the atmosphere in the country. I look at what's happening in Newtown Mankendy, and I'm thinking, look, there's 2,000 people in a village with a population of 3,000. So two-thirds of that village are out marching last Sunday. Okay, there might have been some people from outside Newtown Mankendy there, but they're being applauded down the street. So let's not pretend that this is somehow a fringe in that community. I don't see where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are getting, you know, quotas in that town. And I don't think it's the only town. There's a lot of sympathy with that town. And yet the opinion polls are telling us that they will do just fine. So I'm getting this kind of sense the same way that I did during the referendum, where if the polls are to be believed, there was a big swing in the last week or the week or 10 days. But I think you and I detected it long in advance of that. And at the same time, I also look at the other problem, which is that if you are somebody who thinks, you know, okay, it's time for radical change, then for the first election in my lifetime, you're not without options. The problem is you've got too many of them. In Midlands Northwest, for example, there are, people might dispute the label, but sort of like in the sort of populist lane, the anti-establishment lane of Irish politics, you know, and I'm excluding Sinn Féin, there are 10 candidates out of 28 seeking to claim that mantle from.
But I mean, by the way, just as an aside, if you're a strategist working for Sinn Féin right now, it should chill you to your marrow what you just said there, excluding Sinn Féin from the populist and anti-government vote. That just shows how far gone they are.
Well, I'm sure they'll make a play for it and they'll still get some of it, particularly on the left. And they, and definitely, I mean, there is, and I still encounter them every day of the week, there's still the hardcore Shinner. But I mean, the hardcore Shinner have been voting for them since 1992. So, I mean...
Yeah, but we know what percentage that is and it ain't great.
Yeah, it's about 8% of the population on a good day. I mean, you know, they'll be hoping to do a minimum.
Better than that.
Three times as well as that.
But I also think they're doing something really fascinating, which is that, and I said this to you yesterday, I think... that they're running a campaign to fit an election that happened in the past. Do you know what I mean? So they're running a campaign. The last election, you know, to quote Mary Lou herself, she couldn't walk the length of herself without someone telling her she didn't run enough candidates. So now they're kind of trying to run an old campaign in a new election and thinking it'll, you know what I mean? And I think it's a huge mistake.
You think they're running too many candidates, I think is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that because first of all, they didn't have a good local election. So she's actually referring to the time they didn't run enough candidates was the general election. It wasn't actually the European and local election. But they're trying to kind of fix that somehow, I think, in this election by running like two for Europe in Dublin, multiple candidates and constituencies at the local level. And I think, I mean, I could be totally wrong, but I think that's going to prove to be a mistake.
We shall see. I mean, I think the problem is that there's the I was listening to, of all people, I mean, this is going to surprise people because obviously I have very little in common with this man. But I was listening, I happened on Twitter space during the week and who was being interviewed? Only Justin Barrett, the one-time leader of the National
Party. That's not who I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say somebody completely different.
Exactly. I was listening to Justin. No, I listened to all of it because I looked back, the space went on for like literally 3 hours because Justin Barrett just cannot shut up. I mean, he just goes on at length forever. But I caught a little bit where he was saying that from his perspective, which is obviously on the fringiest fringe of the sort of the populist movement, you know, he thought that there'd be a terrible election, that none of these people would get elected because they're not, in his mind, offering a real clear alternative to the political establishment. But I actually think he might be right about that. I look across the field of candidates and I recognize, obviously, I'm talking against your interests here, and I'm not necessarily talking about every candidate, but I see a lot of people who just are kind of like think that running will get them elected.
Yeah.
You know, that like, you know, just I'll run now. And I mean, I'm just going to use an example of somebody who I know people on this podcast, some of our listeners have indeed emailed in asking why we're not talking about this guy. I'm going to use the example of John Waters. John Waters is not going to get elected. And I'll tell you why John Waters is not going to get elected, which is because he's not running a campaign. He has done like one or two interviews on the internet about why he's running. And a couple of people have shared his picture online. And that's it. You're not running a campaign. I do not expect to see John Waters posters across Midlands Northwest when they come up on Thursday. He hasn't been doing a whole lot of local media. He hasn't been going around touring the country. I'm not even sure if he resides in the constituency that he's running in. He's not going to get elected. And if, I'm sorry if that upsets you, it's just not going to happen. And there are a lot of candidates like that who aren't running campaigns, but who are sticking themselves on the ballot paper and claiming to represent all sorts of alternatives. And it all feels a little bit amateur hour. I'm sorry, it does. And you know, you're obviously involved in a campaign, and you're a pro, so you're trying to do it professionally. And indeed, there are others. I have a piece today about Michael Leahy, who's running for the Irish Freedom Party down in Ireland South, and who is whatever else you might say about the man, he's running a real campaign. But I think there's an awful lot of energy and activism behind sort of, you know, opposing the government, but there's not a lot of focus or professionalism, and there's a whole lot of candidates and no real clear message, and I'm not really clear what I'm getting if I vote for them. I mean, if I'm feeling like that and I'm somebody who actively wants to vote for an alternative, there are a lot of voters out there who just will be utterly confused, I think.
I mean, I think it's that like that it depends on the situation, depends on the candidate, but I think that there's definitely a lot of like political naivety across the board, because the reality of it is that it used to be the situation where you would have, you know, your Fall, your Fine Gael, your and whatever. And like, for the most part, I mean, obviously there'd be new people getting involved in those parties all the time, but there'd be a kind of a wealth of experience within those parties of what politics was, how votes, who turned out, who didn't, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that when you have this whole new influx of people who are new to politics, there's a level of, naturally, there's a level of naivety about what's actually involved. I know somebody who was looking to run and asking, you know, speaking to a few people and spoke to a friend of mine about, you know, wanting to run for Europe or whatever, and cited that the reason why, you know, they thought they would get elected was because they had, I don't know, I can't remember the figure, but let's just say 20,000 TikTok followers. And I was like, I would hazard a guess that 20,000 TikTok followers translates to about 150 votes.
Well, not all of them are going to be in your constituency. Half of them are going to be in America, and half of them are going to be too young to vote. And half of the remainder, by the way, are not going to bother vote.
Like it's irrelevant. Like it would be more politically useful if you had organized a dog grooming day in your local park that would probably get you more votes. Like, do you know what I mean? So there's this kind of naivety about like. Because I say this to people all the time about politics, because like obviously I'm involved in this campaign and just in general, like there's a lot of people who've become more, and I see it in my own friends, like a lot of my female friends who are just much more actively engaged in politics than they were 10 years ago for a variety of reasons. Some of it's their age and their life, and some of it is that politics has just become, you know, more of a hot topic. But like they would be kind of like asking different questions about things and like, what does, like, you know, whatever. But I always say to people, like, until you've been involved in a campaign and then gone to the count and watched the votes spill out onto the table and watched the tallies come in of where and who and how and why, you just can't really comprehend it. And I think that like this election will be the first election for a lot of people who think, like in that example, you know, TikTok or whatever, who think they're going to do really well and then see the boxes open and go, oh, right, there's more to this than, you know, putting up some videos and like putting your name out there. Like in your example, John Waters, like there is a lot more to it. People think about it more. People vote for different reasons. It's not as easy as it looks. And like, that's, you know, that's great. That's part of democracy. People learn, whatever. I still think, though, that going back to your earlier point, that there is a mood out there that is not dissimilar to the mood that I was feeling and you were feeling around the referendum. How that plays out remains to be seen. But I think that, you know, you said yourself that, like, I don't think it automatically follows that the polling was all wrong in the referendum. I think people engage with elections in the last couple of weeks. Like, I think those polls were off, but I don't think they were off as much as people think. I think that there was a momentum in the last 2 weeks. I think there was people don't think about it or talk about it or wonder about it in huge amounts until the last 2 weeks. And I think that this election will be no different in that in the last 2 weeks, you'll see a kind of a crystallization of a move against, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, or maybe a kind of a acquiesce, like people maybe kind of going back a little bit. You know, Sinn Féin is an unknown commodity, but I think that independence and, you know, AIM2 and Independent Ireland and those kind of parties will do well. But I think if the campaign is run correctly in the last 2 weeks, it'll crystallize around that kind of vibe, that kind of idea. And then I think they'll do extremely well.
Yeah, but I think looking at, I mean, I'm looking around as sort of, and I'm trying to be objective about candidates who I think can do well in these elections. I mean, I actually looked at Peter Casey jumping into the race in Ireland Northwest this week. And I'm not saying he's going to win. In fact, I don't think he is, because I'm not sure, with the greatest respect to Peter, who I've only spoken to the man once in my life. He seems like a very nice man, but I'm not sure he's kind of with the zeitgeist of the moment, put it that way. I think he spends a lot of time outside the country for business reasons and so on. But he has some advantages in that he's demonstrated in the presidential election, in which he caused something of a shock by getting a quarter of the vote, that he has a knack for kind of eye-catching sound bites and setting the conversation and setting the agenda. And I think it'll be necessary for candidates who want to succeed to dominate the conversation and to set the agenda and be seen to be the one setting the agenda. And I think that, you know, I'm looking at people like Pádraig Tobin in Ireland Northwest, who's also running. I'm looking at Michael McNamara in Ireland South. I'm looking at your guy in Dublin. I'm not entirely convinced, I have to say, about people like Ciarán Mullooly. I watched a video he put out this week, which talked about volunteering, which is a very noble cause, but seemed to me to be a little bit missing the moment, put it that way. And then I just don't see a lot of people with the capability or the resources to kind of punch through the noise. And I kind of feel like the political system is kind of bracing itself for a shellacking that I'm not sure is going to come. Well, I could be totally wrong. You know, in some ways, I hope I'm totally wrong, but I have to call these things as I see them.
Yeah, I think it's too soon to call.
Yeah, maybe.
I think that the Maluli, that kind of constituency, I don't know that area. I couldn't comment on it at all. But I think that, like, I think constituency by constituency, there'll be different things that will come into play. Let's see.
Do you know what? I want to talk about something else towards the end of the program, because I saw a tweet from Luke Ming Flanagan this morning. It struck me as it rings true with something that has been occurring to me for a couple of weeks now, where he said he was canvassing. Now, obviously, I was just taking his word for it, and he obviously has his own reasons to say these things, and you should never take for granted what a politician says they're hearing on the doors. But he said that he'd been canvassing for a couple of weeks and the cost of living was coming up 10 times as much as immigration was coming up on the doorsteps. Now, I don't know whether that ratio is correct. He obviously has his own reasons for saying it. But it strikes me that the cost of living is kind of sneaking up on the rails, Sarah, as an issue in this country that people aren't talking about. Today, as we're recording this, the carbon tax has gone up again. So the price of fuel has gone up yet again. You've got all sorts of schemes like the bottle farce, whatever that's called, where you're supposed to hand your bottles back and get.
And also, I thought this week this is so funny that the bottle, the charge of the bottles exists in the airport, but they don't have a machine. So basically, you have to bring your bottle on holidays with you.
what I love about that is that there are people out there who will do that.
Of course, because
we all know that there are people out there who will buy their little bottle of orange juice in the airport, take the empty bottle with them to like Portugal, and then bring it back 2 weeks later on principle. And I don't know whether I love those people or hate them, but you know, they exist.
I'm not one of them. So like, you know, it's just, pardon the pun, it's just garbage.
But the bigger issue of the cost of living. I mean, I don't know how many times I've said to my wife recently that it kind of feels like every time I leave the house, no matter where I'm going, no matter what I'm buying, like, you know, it's like leaving the house is a minimum of 50 quid.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're earning the average industrial wage, as they used to say, I mean, like, that works out at something like 600-700 quid a week, then have that if you're paying rent or mortgage. Like, it's, and then you've got a couple of kids. I mean, my wife and I don't have any kids. We both earn decent salaries. I mean, we should be, in theory, you know, absolutely brilliantly off compared to a lot of people, and we probably are. Mm. But I, you know, it's not easy when everything is like 50 quid here, 50 quid there, 100 quid there, 200 quid. Like it's like the cost of living is. I really am noticing it starting to bite in my own life, and as I say, I'm in a more privileged position, partially because we have no kids, than a lot of other people. So, I mean, I think it's an issue that a lot of people are failing to notice and talk about in the political sphere, because in some ways we're kind of so distracted by all these culture war issues, whether it be immigration or law and order or transgenders, whatever it is, that we're not talking about that.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's like a creep. I mean, I have three children, and, you know, Keith finishes work early on Fridays. He usually finishes work on 3 o'clock, and in the summer, because we live in Malahide, in the summer months we'd often, like when he comes home, we'd go down to the village and get something to eat with the kids. That's kind of like a thing that we've kind of fallen into, and we noticed that, like, you know, for us to go, like, three kids, they're small, like they really at best count as kind of one adult, so let's just say that it's a combined three adults, and, like, you know, we wouldn't, like, we'd go for something to eat, might have a drink or whatever. And we really noticed that it used to be a kind of an 80 euro thing. And then it was 100, and then it was 120, and then it was 140. And it just became a thing that wasn't really affordable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's the slow creep of things. And that's not, you know, because I'd be the biggest kind of sympathizer with restaurants and how much it costs. It's not necessarily about them. It's the same thing applies to the food shop, petrol, you know, everything. Like, it's just a really, really expensive time to exist in Ireland.
I also think it's a middle class affliction. And what I say by that is that I think there's because of the country we live in and the recent history of Ireland, from the bust to, but before that, the Celtic Tiger, to the kind of the recovery, to all the talk in the country about, you know, how much money there is in the exchequer, to the fact that there is clearly a lot of wealth in the country, because I don't go a day on the motorway without seeing at least three 2024 reg Merc S classes, for example. So there is clearly a lot of money floating around. And I think there's this kind of societal pressure on middle class people in particular to kind of pretend that they're better off than they are. So it's an issue that doesn't get the same kind of airing, because people don't want to disclose that they're struggling financially, or maybe they're not struggling, but I'm talking about the pressure of things like, you know, if you've got a couple of kids to do the holiday to Portugal or Greece or wherever it is in the summer, to be seen to go to restaurants, to every time, if you get a wedding invitation in your door, I mean, that's, what is it? That's minimum 500 quid these days. That's just gone unless you don't go. Like, there's a lot of pressure on people. And I think societally, there's kind of, it's one of those issues where there is a taboo to talking about it. If you're somebody who has, like, if you're a couple with two jobs and a house and a mortgage and you're financially struggling, there's almost a taboo to talking about it. And I think a lot of the kind of stress that people are feeling on foot of that is kind of buried. Do you think I'm onto something there? Am I dreaming that?
No, I mean, I think there's definitely an undercurrent of that. And I think your point is well made, that people are distracted by other things. And maybe, you know, that suits the government. But I don't know. I mean, like, there's a kind of a, like, there's also a sentiment out there that the economy is probably the thing that's going the best. You get that sense?
Yeah, and I think it's the kind of thing that the government are being led away with, to be honest. I think they're being led away with it. I mean, I think that, you know, you can't say the economy is going really well and then justify jacking up the price of fuel like they've just done today on the grounds that it's saving the planet. I mean, that's hurting people. It's legitimately hurting people. And the economic performance is kind of always measured in Ireland by how well the government is doing. And the government, I wrote about this at the start of the week, the government is doing so unbelievably well. I mean, if you just look at the national balance sheet, this is one of the richest countries in the world. By 2027, our debt to GDP will be 22%, or debt to GNI, which is gross national income, which is a more accurate measure in Ireland because of all the multinationals, will be 40%. So like, our debt is incredibly manageable. The exchequer is going gangbusters. And yet it kind of feels like they're constantly finding new ways to tax us. And to raise even more money, and like it's that the government is constantly, you know, jacking up the cost of living on people without giving anything back. And I'm not talking about big tax cuts. I'm just talking about simple things. Like, I don't know why they reduced the cost. They reduced the taxes on fuel in particular at the start of the Ukraine war, and I don't know any reason why they had to put those back up, apart from the ideological desire of the Greens to punish car users. Like, it's not about helping people. It's about stopping people doing things they don't like.
And I
just think it's adding to the, because I mean, at some point you keep getting told that the country's doing really well. You are, and I'm not talking about, unless people think I'm talking about me. I'm not talking about me, but I'm talking about people I know who have said to me, you know, we're both working, we're told the country's doing really well, we're both earning good salaries, and yet not, we've no money. And like, that is a common experience, I think, in the country. And I think the government isn't really being held to account on that score.
Yeah.
I think it's a vulnerability that they have. And even Sinn Féin, who you think, you know, given all their troubles and travails on the culture wars, could focus on that as an issue, have kind of avoided it. And focus instead on housing. But housing is a symptom of that, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that housing is a symptom of loads of different things, but the cost of living is kind of a thing. You know, that old political thing where, you know, people will be happy if they can kind of, you know, pay all their bills, go for something to eat on a Friday night and take their kids on a holiday once a year. That, like, that's the kind of baseline. And if that is satisfied, then, like, you're probably okay. Everything on top of that is kind of bonus. And I think that isn't the case for a huge proportion of the Irish public. But I think that on the one hand, the government is being hammered on immigration, but on the other hand, you know, it's serving as a distraction from the day to day.
Yep. Well, it's all very interesting. We'll keep talking about it over the next couple of weeks. Before we say goodbye, was there anything else that struck your as worthy of conversation?
Not this week. I'm going to follow the story of the Social Democrats and how they're going to manage this Jewish candidate that they've removed from the party with interest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure they'll pay a price, unfortunately. I think I was looking at some of the reaction to it online, and particularly on the left, I think there's...
Well, I mean, I don't think they're going to pay a price on that specific issue, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think the Soc Dems are going to not have a good election.
I think that's...
And Labour are going to get hammered.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be surprising if the Greens end up doing better than either of them, which I think might happen. But we can talk about that another time. For those of you who've been on at me about my sound quality for the last couple of weeks, I have debuted this week a brand new and eye-wateringly expensive microphone. So hopefully you've felt the benefit of that. We didn't talk much about the comments and stuff that we received last week because, frankly, I'm so busy, I didn't have a chance to read them. So I apologize for that. We'll catch up with your comments and feedback next week. But until then, from Sarah and from myself, I think we'd both like to wish you a very happy bank holiday weekend and a relaxing one, unlike the one Sarah will have, as she desperately tries to find people to put up posters and hands out leaflets. You volunteered for it. It's not my fault.
Thanks.
All right. Listen, take care, everybody. We will talk to you in a week. Until then, that was the week that really was.